In a world in which movies struggle to find plot, Alan Adams of The Main Edge breaks it down for you in Pass the Popcorn. Now on Downtown with Rich Kimball.
Yeah.
Let's all go to the lobby.
Pass the Popcorn, our Let's chance to talk to movies with the film critic Let's of The Main Edge. His work is, well, it's everywhere. Rotten Tomatoes. Sometimes he'll just call people at random and say, hey, you ought to see this movie. I think you'll like it. Alan Adams here with us. Hello, Al.
Hello. How are you?
Wonderful. You?
I'm good, thanks. I'm good.
The weekend went well?
It was pretty good. Yeah, we actually did some stuff around the house. Did some touch-up painting on the porch.
Oh, my.
Yeah, did a little bit of that. Did a trip to Home Depot and, got paint. And whatnot.
Good time.
Did a quick scan of the Halloween decorations. I was holding out hope that they'd have one of those 15-foot skeletons, but they did not have one in stock, which was, which is probably for the best, because I don't really need one of those, but I know for a fact that if the opportunity to buy one is presented directly to me, I'm going to buy it.
Now, is the plan once again at Shea Adams for the full-size candy bars this year?
So far as I know. Like, I kind of want to be that house. I'm not going to lie. Like, that's I've greatly enjoyed, and it's one of those things where we're far enough removed from the major traffic where that's not a complete nightmare.
So you don't get the Maple Street spinoff?
We get some, but mostly it's the people who have to park on our street because they can't park closer. we have some kids in the neighborhood, and so that's nice. I will probably bust out the candy chute again.
Big hit last year.
Yeah,
right?
No, people really seem to dig it. That was always the plan, and now that it appears that the smoldering embers are catching fire again everywhere, that's probably for the best, I would say.
Does Stella freak out on Halloween night?
She sure does.
Oh, yeah.
Yep, she sure does. She gets very, it's a bunch of strangers approaching her house.
Yeah.
She barks at them when it's just, people in the neighborhood closing their doors. So you get little, like, ghouls and goblins just showing up and, like, being all demanding and stuff. She's like, you need to get out of here.
Ginger just paces. Like, when's the next one? When's the next one? Why are we giving them things? What is happening? Who are these people? I don't know them. Who are they?
You're just making it worse.
Right, right. They keep coming back. If you give them candy, geez. You saw three movies.
I did.
This week. Well, we'll talk about them. Well, I think we want to save one of them for last, because if you're going to fall apart here in studio, then
right.
We want that at the end.
Sure, that makes sense.
So where should we begin?
Let's start with Queenpins.
Yeah.
Because the cover story in last week's Main Edge, Mike Dow went long with Aaron Gaudet and Gita Palapoli, the directors, writers-directors of this film. It's a real bummer because it's not screening anywhere here. It's Cinemark exclusive, and there are no Cinemark theaters in our immediate vicinity. But for those who are who want to see this, I will say it's supposed to come to I believe it's Paramount Plus, the streaming service.
Good.
At the end of the month, so it will be here before you know it. It's one of those things where it's like I'm always. In these sorts of situations, I'm always a little hesitant because I'm like, okay, so these people gave all this wonderful access to our publication and, spent all this time talking about their movie. They were nice enough to grant me access to a screener. What do I do if it sucks? those moments have come in the past. Happily, Queenpins does not suck.
Good.
Yes,
good.
I was very about 15 minutes in, I finally was able to just sort of exhale. I'm like, okay, it's okay. This is gonna be good. Like, this is gonna be okay. Sheridan and I sat down and watched it, and we really enjoyed it. So the basic gist, it's kind of a heist story, kind of a caper story. You've got this woman, Connie, played by Kristen Bell. She's a former Olympic race walker. Living in Phoenix with her husband, Rick, played by Joel McHale, who's an IRS auditor. They've been struggling with fertility issues and have gone into significant debt pursuing solutions to those issues. Nothing's really worked. And so to sort of fill a void in her life, Connie has taken to really embracing the couponing lifestyle. you know, the sorts of people who, collect from all the neighbors and and compound coupons and know where to go and when and have all the tips and tricks and whatnot. Her best friend, Jojo, played by the wonderful Kirby Howell Baptiste, is also of a couponing mind. She has a YouTube channel where she posts lifestyle tip videos and things like that. But, you know, she also lives at home with her mom because her identity was stolen and her credit was destroyed. So, you know, these two are both sort of struggling. They spend their time working out these ways to sort of increase their savings. But then circumstances, I'm not going to reveal too much, circumstances lead them to an idea where they could greatly increase their couponing reach, so much so that they would be able to procure, in a shady fashion, we'll say, extra coupons, which could then be resold for half, for a percentage of face value, making them money while also saving the people who received said coupons, saving them a considerable amount of money themselves. So that's the scheme. Initially starts slow, but before long, it really starts to blow up and the money starts rolling in. And that's when they start to draw, the wrong sort of attention. Specifically, there's a guy named Ken, played by Paul Walter Hauser, who's wonderful in this movie. Who's a loss prevention officer for a regional grocery store chain. And he starts to notice these coupons that are showing up that are absolutely indistinguishable from the real thing, but they're not valid coupons. He complains, he takes his complaint to the FBI, he really sends it up the chain. Nothing happens because, again, the FBI is not interested in weird coupon guy from Arizona. But eventually, when it becomes clear that these transactions are happening through the mail, the U.S. Postal Inspectors get involved. Specifically, a U.S. Postal Inspector by the name of Al, played by Vince Vaughn. And so in the back half of this movie, in addition to the sort of rising star of Connie and Jojo, we also get the weird sort of odd couple buddy comedy dynamic between the aforementioned grocery store loss prevention officer and the U.S. Postal Inspector. They circle each other for a while. I'm not going to spoil how it plays out. You can probably guess. But that's where we get. It's this wonderful sort of little adventure. The performances are phenomenal. Like, Kristen Bell's great. She's great in whatever she does. Yep. And this is the kind of flavor of comedy that she particularly excels at. There's a quirkiness here that I think really works for her. Howell Baptiste, she's also very good. And the great thing about it is, like, she and Kristen Bell have worked together numerous times on various projects. Right. She was on Veronica Mars. She was on The Good Place. Like, they've really known each other for a very long time. And that reads. Like, it's one of those things where, it's like, oh, well, they're actors. They'll just act like they know each other, And it's like, you've done it. I've done it. Like, it's not as easy as that.
Right.
And so when you have real chemistry and you can see that real chemistry, like, it really goes a long way towards enhancing the viewing experience. And then on the flip side, you've got the man, Paul Walter Hauser. Like, can't he play just the most endearing, off-putting dude? Like, he's just really making a career out of these by the book weirdos who should not be charming and yet somehow are charming. whether you're talking about the stuff in I, Tonya or God, like Richard Jewell,
right.
He has that sort of character kind of locked down. And then you have Vince Vaughn kind of playing it straight, which is you don't see a lot of that from him anymore. It's worth remembering that, 20 years ago, Vince Vaughn was like he's a very talented actor, and I know he's sort of gone down some strange paths with regards to the choices that he's making, but he's still very talented. And so it was really interesting to see him kind of stretch a different set of muscles. Joel McHale doesn't get a lot to do, but he's great. He's the snarky a-hole, and that kind of fits him.
Hello.
Steven Root shows up for one scene, and it's just like, oh man, it's Steven Root. Let's see what he does. He's like an FBI suit, and he's great. And it's just a lot of fun. And the scheme itself, based on real life, It's kind of fascinating to watch how it all kind of unfolds, and a lot of there's some really good laughs, some wonderful character stuff, and it's just it's a lot of fun.
Well, I'm glad to hear it. I'm happy for Aaron and Gita, and can't wait to see it. If hopefully it'll get up here into the theaters, but if not, streaming soon.
Yes.
Awesome. All right, let's talk about Malignant. Did it scare you? Was it intense?
It's funny. Like I hadn't really thought about this until I sat down to write the review, but I'm like, man, is there like, if you're making a list of the people, like the most influential figures in genre filmmaking in the 21st century, like James Wan has to be on that list. Mm. Like, I mean, we're talking about the guy who kicked off the Saw franchise. Like he, you know, he made, you know, a couple of the Insidious movies, the Conjuring universe he kicked off. You know, so he's got that sort of horror vibe on lockdown, but he also directed the 7th Fast and Furious movie and Aquaman. Like, this is a guy who basically is, you know, they talk about 4-quadrant sort of movies. Like, he's a 4-quadrant director. Like, he's made pretty much every kind of, like, you know, mainstream sort of popcorn fare. He's very much back to his roots in Malignant, which, Rich, is one of the more bonkers horror movies that I've seen in some time. It's the kind of movie that has a very, very visceral attitude with regard to the genre. A lot of blood, a lot of noises that are unsettling, that involve that you know, the springing directly from the blood, and one of the most lunatic third act sort of pivots that I've seen in a movie in a very long time, like to the point where it's like, it's horrifying, but you also laugh because it's like, oh my God, I can't believe this is actually happening right now. So the basic gist, we start in 1993. The opening shot is we come around this, we're in this sort of heavily wooded area. We come around this corner and there's this big hospital, like dark and spooky hospital on top of a cliff overlooking the ocean, and you're like, oh, so this is what we're doing. like a perfect sort of over-the-top introduction to exactly what kind of movie we're going to get. We go into the hospital, and there are these doctors and aides and whatnot, and they're all in a tizzy because he got out. Like, that's all they keep saying. He got out. And all this, like, the lights are flickering, and, like, we keep going around corners, and there's, like, unconscious people. Maybe they're dead. Maybe they're not. There's a lot of blood everywhere. We find out that whoever he is, they're trying to keep him restrained. He also has, apparently, along with superhuman strength, also some sort of connection with electricity. It's unclear. They don't make any explanations. Sometimes that bothers me, sometimes it doesn't. It does not bother me here. Like, I'm just like, you've already got me. Like, I'm ready to go wherever you want to go. And then cut to the present day. We meet Madison, played by Annabelle Wallace. She's living in Seattle. She's pregnant, you know, living with her husband. She's had a couple of miscarriages, and so is dealing with the emotional fallout of that. Gets into a fight with her husband. He makes the shift from emotional abuse to physical abuse, pushes her. She hits her head on the wall, and then locks herself in to be safe. Hours pass. When she goes out, her husband has been murdered gruesomely by some sort of shadowy figure. Mm-hmm. Shadowy figure still there, attacks her. She blacks out, wakes up in the hospital. Her sister is there. Her sister, played by Maddie Hassan, tells her she's lost the baby. She's devastated, but she still has to talk to the police before she can go home. And she starts having these vivid dreams, like these very gruesome dreams, sort of a sleep paralysis kind of situation where she is seeing something happening, usually a brutal murder of some sort. And she can't do anything about it. She's very visceral, very real. She's terrified. Then it turns out some of the things that she's seeing are actually happening.
Hmm.
And so, you know, there are these, you know, so how is that happening? That's the question. And so the answer to that question leads back to the aforementioned creepy hospital on a cliff, in a very, complicated way. But again, it's hard to talk about it without sort of, giving away the aforementioned, bonkers twist, but we'll just say, it turns out that her her shadowy pursuer is willing to do just about anything to get to her and exact revenge for the perceived slights done to him. We'll leave it at that. It's so, like, it's the first hour and 15, you're like, oh, this is a pretty good movie. It's not super scary. Like, it's a little too over the top to be that kind of scary. Like, not a lot in the way of jump scares or anything like you sometimes get in modern horror movies. Very straightforward, again, on the bloody side, kind of gory, but engaging, you know, and Juan has a great sense of atmosphere. So he does a really good job of sort of creating the world in which we're living. And then we hit that moment, we get that reveal, and it's just like we go into this place of just absurd, like full-on Cronenbergian, like body horror stuff, where it's just like, I don't understand, like, and it's explained to you in this sort of clinical manner where and you're like, yeah, but still, this is really just horrifying to look at. But you're laughing because it's so much.
I'm reading about the twist right now.
Yeah. And it,
wow.
Right. And it's like, you know, and if someone's going to watch that movie, like, I can't tell you what's going to happen. Well, Dave, who used to work here at the station, posted on Facebook last night. He was talking about, and he's like, pretty good so far. And I'm like, man, just you wait. I hope to talk to him soon because I would love to know what he thought. Because what I thought was, how is this happening right now? I say all this. I actually dug the movie. Like when I was done, I was so sort of thrown by what had happened that I'm like, oh, this movie, I don't know. Like I'm not really feeling it. I don't know that it really works. But with a little bit of remove, I'm like, oh man, that James Wan knows exactly what he's doing. He just set me up. He's like, oh yeah, you think you know how haunted house movies work, and you know all these horror tropes. So here's one, and here's one, and here's one, and then he just flips the table, and you're just like, oh, and then so you're forced to kind of look back at what you've seen before, and you're just like, oh man, he was playing me the whole time, and so yeah, like again, it's the sort of movie that could prove triggering for any number of reasons. So if you have sensitivity, to particularly, you know, things like, the idea of miscarriage or domestic violence or just like an aversion to blood, like this movie is 100% not for you. I would advise you to steer clear. But if you are a horror aficionado who is comfortable with storytelling, that involves those sorts of things, I gotta say it is an experience. I will say I watched it on HBO Max. It is precisely the sort of horror movie that I kind of wish I'd been able to see in a full movie theater, because when that moment hit, like I can hear in my head the sorts of reactions that people would have in the moment seeing what is happening. But yeah, Malignant. It's solid. It's solid horror. And again, you will be surprised.
All right. Talking with Alan Adams of The Main Edge. And finally, in our trio of films this week, a recording of a live presentation of the Broadway musical Come From Away, especially appropriate given the weekend that we just went through.
Right. This is a story about a small town in Newfoundland that played host to, I think the number was 38 planes were diverted to their airport. Some 7,000 people brought to a town of a population of 9,000. The days that they spent together while the flights were grounded and they couldn't return to wherever it was they were returning to. You know, and we've talked about this a little bit, I think, in the past. I'm not usually a fan of the filmed stage show. It's, you know, and again, not adaptations. I'm not talking about that. Like, I'm just talking about when you just point a camera at a stage where a show's going on. Like, most of the time, like, you lose this sort of immediacy and the energy of live performance, but you also lose the production value and delicacy of filmmaking. So it's literally a lose-lose situation most of the time. And I can't stress enough, most of the time. Because then you get things that remind you that every rule has its exceptions. And this is very much that. So the musical, also called Come From Away, book, music, and lyrics by Irene Senkoff and David Hine. It first hit Broadway, I think, right around 5 years ago, 4 or 5 years ago, I guess. And again, it tells this the story of this small town that brings all these people in as 9/11 is happening. Like, it's, again, it's very much a film play, not a movie. But they've done a really good job of sort of integrating. And when I say, what I mean by that is, it's, you know, they found a way to sort of organically engage and steer the viewer in a way that, you know, a lot of filmmakers just don't understand with regards to stage. Like, you know, there are plenty of the wide shots, but they know when to go. They know when to go close. There's some great overhead shots, a couple of good handheld shots, you know, and it's just like the director of the film production knows where we should be looking. And so that's where we're looking. Mm. And so it really does kind of capture a lot of that sort of live musical energy while also still being very much a filmed piece. So the basic gist of the story, it's the morning of September 11th, 2001, pretty much like any other day in the small Newfoundland town of Gander. You know, the mayor's out in the town getting the lay of the land. The teachers are getting ready for school. One of the town's two police officers is out writing warning tickets for speeders because, you know, they're Canadian. They're not going to give actual tickets. You know, there's a new girl taking over the local news station, and the school bus drivers are threatening to strike. Small town stuff. It also Gander is also a place that once upon a time was a primary refueling stop for transatlantic flights,
right.
And so they have this massive airport. And granted, now that jets can do that flight without refueling, you know, the airport is considerably less active. But then, you know, disaster strikes. And all planes in the air are directed to land immediately. And what this means is 38 planes with something like 7,000 passengers wind up landing on the airfield at Gander. That's where they stay for the next 5 days. And this small town, these lovely regular people just sort of open their doors. Like they, you know, they really mobilize, like everybody, donations and volunteers and keeping everybody fed and clothed, giving them places to sleep, you know, and, you know, as, you know, as days go by, like these people are, you know, they're just like, oh, why don't you just come to my house for a shower and a meal. And, you know, maybe you don't want to sleep on a floor for a night. So, and just like this entire community embracing strangers from all over the world who have been trapped by circumstance in this place. And, you know, and all the people, the passengers on these planes, they have their fears as well. Like they're scared. No one really knows what's happening. Like it's all still very fresh and very raw. And, you know, and they're trying to deal with their own circumstances. And the people of Gander are just simply opening their arms and just giving them kindness. It's just all about the kindness that comes from a community. I'm not going to lie to you, Rich. Like I didn't even make it through the opening number before I started getting a little misty. And it just went from there. Like, I mean, the stories that these people were telling, and I'm not going to go into the specifics because honestly, I went in pretty cold. Like I was aware of the show. I knew the basic premise, but I had never heard any of the songs. Like I didn't know the specifics of the plot. And I'm so glad that that's how I went in because, I think seeing this with fresh eyes was something that I really, really needed. I think like just, there was a catharsis to it, that I think really, was really helpful for me personally. And I think will prove very helpful for a lot of people, like just that sort of emotional release built around this idea of just people being good to each other.
Right.
Like, it's so easy to forget that, especially now. You know, and so to have something that celebrates that fundamental goodness of people was just really wonderful.
And what, now, and what service is it on?
It's Apple TV Plus.
Okay, great.
And yeah, and look, it's, I mean, none of this matters if you don't have, you know, a great ensemble. This one is like, it's 12 people and they're playing all the parts.
Multiple roles.
Yeah, yeah. Like, and it's just like, you know, all they're doing, it's like, from they're turning around and like changing their hat, and all of a sudden it's a different person. Like I love stuff like that when it's well executed, and these folks are just flawless. Like, I mean, just the distinction that they're creating. Like, they're playing half a dozen, 7-8 characters, and they're just shifting from moment to moment in a way that is really just proof that they've put together just a tremendous amount of talent. The songs slap. Like, these nice. Are like, the music is fantastic, and we talked about this a little bit off the air. One of the things that I wasn't anticipating, though I probably should have, was there's a real consciousness with regard to maritime music. It's, you've got your standard sort of rock pit with like guitars and bass and a drum kit, but you've also got mandolins and a fiddle and hand drummers and and all these sorts of much more traditional sort of instrumental vibes, these flavors from that region. And when you combine them, it just creates something that's familiar, but you've never really heard something quite like this before. And top to bottom, the songs are great. The performances, I'm not going to name any names because it's that kind of ensemble where it's just like, it doesn't matter. Like, there are a couple of people that you could maybe argue are the quote unquote stars, but I mean, it's just one of those casts where it's just like top to bottom rock solid. And you just, every single one of them, finds a moment to do something compelling or evocative that just grabs you by the heartstrings and plucks away.
Can't wait to see it. Come From Away, Apple TV Plus. Alan Adams from The Main Edge, thanks as always.
My pleasure.
See you Wednesday.
Yes, sir.